then you'll be able to confine the contextuality to particular observables, and it will have an experimentally measurable signature there, which is an anomalous weak value. So that's sort of the long and short of what we're going to talk about. And I think this basically just says all of that. But the main thing is that we have the BKS theorem forbidding a certain type of hidden variable model. These are measurement non-contextual models with outcome determinism. So that's the presumption that you should be able to assign a prediction eigenvalue to every observable, such that regardless of what context you measure that observable in, that's the value you'll get. So it's independent of the context. And Kochenspecker's sets are sets of possible counterfactual measurements that rule out this type of model. So this is an example of one. So this is the 3-qubit square. So each of the rows and columns of this thing, so the whole row along the top, or this whole column, are a set of 3 mutually commuting observables. So they have a joint eigenbasis. I can measure all 3 at once in a single measurement. And they also have the property that the rows of this figure have products. I'm going to come to that on the next slide. So again, for the non-contextual hidden variable theory, the idea is that I should have to assign a value plus or minus 1, an eigenvalue, to each of these 9 observables, such that if I measure the row and get that observable, or if I measure the column and get that observable, it has the same value. So really, we're just going to pick 9 values. If we had a fully contextual model, I could say freely that ZIZ gets one value in this context and a different value in this context. But we're going to consider the other kind of case where we think it's non-contextual. And then the other constraint here is that the product along each row of this thing is positive identity, and the product along each column of it is negative identity. And what that means is that the eigenvalues that are assigned in this prediction, if they're going to be consistent with what happens when we actually do the measurement, have to obey that sign constraint. So the product of the 3 values I put on a row has to be positive. The product of the 3 I put on a column has to be negative. And there's a parity argument with this particular set. You'll be able to see that it's impossible to assign 9 values like that, such that all 6 of those product rules will be obeyed. So let's see why that is. So if I consider the overall product of all 3 rows and all 3 columns, and I look at value assignments, then if I've put a value here, plus or minus 1, when I look at that overall product, the value appears here once, and then again there twice. And so the overall product is going to be the product of each of these 9 eigenvalues squared. And that's obviously going to be plus 1. But if I look at the predictions of quantum mechanics, I have 3 columns that give a negative value and 3 rows that give a positive value. And so according to the quantum predictions, the product of these 6 has to be negative. So what that tells us is that there isn't going to be a way to assign 9 values to this thing that will obey those product rules. So if we did assign 9 non-contextual values, plus and minus 1, to this set, there has to be at least 1 row or column where the product rule is going to be violated. But when we do experiments with these sets, we never see that violation. And so this leads people to conclude that these types of models don't exist. But we're going to try to do something where we see in what way we can keep the... Actually, yeah, okay. We'll get into this. But what I want to say about the BKS set is that if we actually do consider a case where we have all 9 values, there has to be some particular column where the thing is violated, but we never see it. So we never know in an experiment which of these it would have been. In some sense, if there was a violation when we prepare the state, when we do our random choice of measurements and look, we never catch that violation. So it's almost as though it shuffled itself away, or maybe there was some kind of a bizarre constraint and we weren't allowed to look at that one. So if you try to really adhere to the picture that these values exist, you run into some very conceptually tricky things. There's just more reasons to think that these models don't actually exist. All right, so I'm going to take a detour, talk about the weak value for a moment. So you have an ensemble of experiments that you will prepare all the same state psi, and you post-select all the same state phi. The post-selection means that I do some measurement at the end. Phi is one of the outcomes of that measurement. And I just keep only the ensemble of experiments where I got phi in the end. So I have an overall ensemble, and I pull out a sub-ensemble that corresponds to always preparing this state and always getting this one final outcome. And we can define the weak value using the pre and post selection. So the weak value of any observable A, given this spectral decomposition over here in terms of its eigenvalues and projectors in its basis, is given by this formula. And we can also see that You can always re-explain this as the sum of the weak values of the projectors times their eigenvalue. So really all you have to talk about are the projectors, and you'll be able to reconstruct any observable anyway. So from now on, we'll just focus on the weak values of projectors. Now, the way the weak measurement actually works, between that pre and post selection, if we couple the system very weakly to a pointer for one of these observables, then as long as it's so weak that it doesn't cause any disturbance on an individual run, if we look at the ensemble average effect on that pointer after a whole ensemble of runs, the weak value is what we'll find. That's what will pop out. And for projectors, the weak values should be, or sorry, the eigenvalues are 1 and 0. And we would expect that any stochastic average of those should be between 1 and 0. But we're also going to find that weak values can actually be much above 1, much below 0. We call those anomalous weak values. And there's a recent paper from Matt Pusey that shows that anomalous weak values are independently a proof of contextuality using a generalized definition of contextuality due to Rob Speckens, who is sitting in the back there. So that's what we're gonna kind of bring all this together now. I'm gonna introduce one more thing we need sort of to complete the story. So the Aronov-Bergman-Lebowitz rule is a rule that tells you about the probability of getting some outcome between a given pre and post selection had you done a strong projective measurement in some basis B. And because you're talking about a pre and post selection, there's a really nice way to express this formula in terms of the weak values of the projectors in that basis given the same pre and post selection. So we can express it just as the weak value of the one we're curious about divided by the sum of the mod square weak values of the individual ones. And this is really the important thing. For any basis, the sum of the projectors is identity. And that means that for any basis, the sum of the weak values of the projectors is 1. And if we use that fact, we can see that if we have any basis that has a cardinality of 2, so there are just 2 projectors, regardless of what ranks they have, then this formula will follow. If we know the weak value, if we know that the weak value is 1, put that in up here, then we know the probability according to the ABL formula is also 1, because the basis can only actually have a 1 and a 0, given that there are only 2 elements in the basis, in order to obey this rule. So what we conclude here is that if we measure a projector's weak value and we find that it's 1, we know that had we done a strong measurement during the intermediate time, we would have found it was 1 also. And so this sort of gives us a reason to want to include this extra value in our eigenvalue assignment that we're going to get for a KS set. Independently, there's a proof by Liefer and Pusey that under certain assumptions of non-contextuality, this also has to be there in your model. So you can kind of see it 2 different ways. So now let me actually bring this all together, and you'll see what I mean. So we have our square again. We pre-select this state, the plus x eigenstate for all 3 qubits, and we post-select the plus y eigenstate for all 3 qubits. And what that does is the x's for the pre-selection fix these values. The y's for the post-selection fix these values. And then we apply that ABL probability rule, and that has the effect of fixing, from this basis we get this value, from this basis we get this value, from this basis that value. And now we see that right up here, the product rule will be violated in that column. So we actually know which context it is now, given the pre and post selection, where the product rule is violated. But this set of eigenvalues, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, they don't correspond to any projector in Hilbert space, because the product of these observables is positive identity. So there's no way we can directly ever measure this effect, but we can do something else. We can look at the projectors in this basis, the actual projectors that do exist in Hilbert space, and we can weakly measure them. And then we'll find that there's going to be an anomalous weak value in that basis. And this is sort of an important point. The fact that there's going to be an anomalous weak value in that basis is not just arbitrary. It follows exactly from the algebraic structure of this set. If this were not a KS set, this thing would not be forced to be anomalous. So we really are seeing the signature of the Kochan-Specker contextuality sort of concentrated or confined into one particular context of the set. So I glossed over that these are all rank 2 projectors. So we don't have enough generators to fully nail down rank 1 projectors. The 3 qubits, but instead of 8 rank 1s, we have 4 rank 2s. So the 4 that are in that basis are these 4. So this is the case that all 3 qubits are plus, plus the case that all 3 qubits are minus. And just to go back for a second, you can see that if both of these are plus, this is plus, both are plus, plus, both are plus, plus, or if both of these are minus, then it's plus also. So it works for either case. So that's what I mean, is that it's a rank two projector because there are two ways to assign values to the three individual Z operators that will give you this assignment, you know, one of the four assignments for those Zs. And these are the different four different ways you can do it. So in particular, we're going to look at the weak value of the first projector in this list here. So we'll go through and construct it. So given that projector, our pre and post selection from before, the X's and Y's, we can expand this thing out into this form. And you can see that I've written this as this tensor triple. That's because the entire thing is factorable. So you end up getting this formula, but you can actually write the whole thing down in terms of the weak values of individual qubits. That's because the pre-selection was a product state, the post-selection is a product state, and these terms are also products. So that's going to be a big simplification that when we do the experiment, which I'll talk about next, we only actually have to measure weakly one qubit at a time, and we can construct the overall projector for the three-qubit case afterwards. And in the end, we do find this weak value comes out to be negative 1/2, so that's our anomalous weak value for our projector, as promised. And we'll find that the other three in this actually are positive 1/2, because the sum has to be 1. So now we have our evidence that we've confined the contextuality to a particular basis, and there's going to be this anomalous weak value that we can look at. We can actually do experiments to see this. It's not a counterfactual thing. We can really observe this effect. That's the difference between the usual Kochenspecker tests and this weak value trick. So what I was saying is we can do these single qubit measurements. So we're actually going to be measuring ZJ. This is the weak value of the poly Z operator on each of the qubits. And then we're going to need to use their individual projector weak values, which we can just construct from those like this. So really, all we've ever measured is this, and we can construct the plus or the minus projector weak value from that data. And we're able to compute the weak value of any of these three-qubit projectors using the same Z data, so we're actually able to get all four and figure out what their values are. And the three-qubit square actually can be generalized into a family of n-qubit KS proofs that go for all odd n. And all of the logic I just explained will follow exactly the same way. So in the experiment, we actually did 17 different qubits. What we really did was, this was a neutron interferometry experiment. So we did one ensemble of runs of neutrons through the interferometer, called that qubit 1. Then we later did another ensemble and called it qubit 2. And we did 17 such sub-ensembles. Each ensemble allows us to characterize a weak value for what we call qubit 1, qubit 2, qubit 3, et cetera. And yeah, we did the n-qubit wheel for all the odd n. So let's just look at the one for 5. So this is the generalized KS set for the 5-qubit wheel. So now the outer rings are each mutually commuting, or each of the rings is mutually commuting, and their products are all positive identity. And each of these spokes is mutually commuting, and its product is negative identity. And you can see there's sort of a pattern here. This is ZZXXYY is the stabilizer group of a Bell state for the first 2 qubits, second 2 qubits, and next two, the next two, and then first and last. And this pattern just generalizes all the way up. You just have some odd number of spokes, and you're joining adjacent qubits using these Bell pairs. And then the pre-selection is just for all n qubits plus x, and post-selection is plus y. It fixes the plus values, the minus values, and the ABL rule on each spoke forces us to have our conflict in the outer ring. So the logic follows exactly the same way, and we'll again find an anomalous weak value. Now, in the Kochenspecker sets, you saw that it's actually the whole context that gets a violation. And so it's a little bit odd to think that it's just one projector in that set that actually is anomalous. Why is it one projector and not another? So there's a way to construct an unbiased measure where you take data from all of the different projectors in a given basis and combine it together to get a single contextuality witness for the whole context, so all of the projectors in that basis. So the way that works is we construct this quantity. These SI are just going to be signs, and these come from the theoretically predicted value of the weak value. So we take the real part of the weak value, take its sign, and then these, well, this is just an operator, but when we actually do the measurement, these will become the real weak values from the data. So you can see if you look that regardless of what signs I put here, if all of the weak values of the projectors are between 0 and 1, this number is always going to be 0 or greater. Doesn't matter what the signs are. But we've chosen the signs to sort of optimize it so that it will actually be able to go below 0 if some of the individual weak values are above 1 or below 0. So if they're above 1, that's a proof of contextuality. If they're below 0, that's a proof of contextuality. So what we want to do is gather all of those gaps. How much is it above 1? How much is it below 0? Put those all together into a single number so we see just how non-contextual the basis actually is. So this is our witness. And just using the same proof of contextuality that Pusey gave for the anomalous weak values of the projectors, we find that if this witness has a weak value below 0, or the real part is below 0, then we have a proof of contextuality. So we did this 17 qubits. Here are our data. So over here are the weak values. The blue dots are the theoretically predicted weak values. The orange is the experiment with some error bars. These are for the full contextuality witness over here. And this tells you how many standard deviations in our data we violated this bound of 0 by. So you can see sort of how robust these violations are. And over here, what we did is we picked out a single projector for each number of qubits. And there's a sort of funny geometric property that we were not expecting to be there, but it turns out that it's really there. And that is that for certain cases, for the every other odd number, 5, 9, 13, 17, that's most striking for 5. There's just a sort of symmetry property in the projector that the weak value is insensitive to first order errors. And so you get a really, really small error when you construct this thing. And so for this one, we get 99 sigma violation of the bound. And then this one's pretty good too, but the rest are all kind of hovering around the same values as here. They're just washed out because you notice this only goes between 5 and 7 sigmas, and this goes up to 100. So in different scales. All right, so this is the actual setup we used. So this is a neutron interferometer. The experiment was done at the Institut Lau Langevin in Grenoble, France, by the group of Yuji Hasegawa, who's sitting back here with us. So this is a prism that sort of pre-selects the spin, and then this is a DC coil that actually like finishes aligning it. It's an overall guide field to preserve everything. The system we're actually going to be measuring is the spin of the neutron. So the weak measurement is actually performed here by these two Helmholtz coils. They weakly couple the path and the interferometer to the spin of the neutron. And then there's a phase shifter here, a cadmium slab that can be used to block one of the beam paths. And then we have a helium-3 detector over here and over here. And this DC coil and this polarizing mirror have the effect of post-selecting the neutron. So only the neutrons that have the final state we want end up making it to that detector. Okay. So this is the overall setup for the interferometer. And again, what we did was 17 large ensembles of neutrons through this thing, each of which we collected data for and called one qubit. All right, so now we're going to move beyond the experiment. This was a more recent idea. We can kind of get to a state-independent proof of contextuality. So the Kokenschmecker theorem is originally state-independent, but you're never able to confine the contextuality. But if you start with that any of those wheel structures, what will happen is if you just do any preselection in the all product X basis, up to all, you know, regardless of what the signs are, and you do any post-selection in the all product Y basis, regardless of what the signs are, the ABL rule will still force a product rule violation into that outer ring of the wheel. And there's a way you can aggregate the data for all of the different runs. So the way this would work is, I put in some state. I don't even care what that state is. It doesn't even have to be the same every time. And then I do this pre-selection measurement, and I get one of these outcomes, psi j. And then I do my weak coupling to it in the intermediate time in the z basis, and then I post-select, and I take any of the outcomes of the post-selection. So I'm going to collect all of the data. So for each outcome j and k for the pre-selection and post-selection, we can define one of these contextuality witness observables. And then we can put all of them together for all of the data, all the different outcomes we would have gotten. This isn't an observable anymore because there are different pre and post selections here. So it's a sum over weak values from all the different data in the run. And again, we get a witness now that uses all of these individual ones. And for the same reason as before, any value of this thing that's below 0 is a proof of contextuality. And I did this in response to a question about the statistics of this experiment. So this one is nice because we don't have to throw away any data. We can keep every single run of the experiment. That may allay some criticisms about this. So that's all I'm going to say about that. It's just sort of a tangent. So now I'm going to come to talking about interpretations of these different things. So the quantum pigeonhole effect was an idea that Yakir Aronov, I think he was the one that originated a couple of years ago. And it actually relates exactly to the chaos set that I was showing you. So what happens in these chaos sets is that we have many pairs of qubits, and we find this correlation using the ABL rule. Remember, we use the ABL rule to force those ZZ values. And we find this correlation, this anti-correlation, between every pair of these neutrons, even though they never interacted, nor were they even in the interferometer at the same time at all. And this, if you sort of interpret this verbally, it seems to contradict the pigeonhole principle, which comes from classical mathematics. It just says that if you have three or more pigeons and you put them in two boxes, you have to have at least two pigeons in one of the boxes. Seems fairly obvious. So I guess it's sort of difficult to prove mathematically. I've never looked at the proof. Surprisingly difficult to prove. So if we let the plus the eigenstate be a left box and the minus the eigenstate be a right box, then this ZZ minus one says that the two pigeons are always in opposite boxes. What that means is that for all 17 pigeons, we put them all in two boxes, but if we ask any two, are you in the same box, they always say no. So that seems to violate that principle. So this is ascribing a particular kind of ontological interpretation to the actual data we saw from our confined contextuality experiment. So that's one. And then there's also the Cheshire Cat, which is an experiment that was also done by Yuji's group a couple of years ago. And so this is actually the Peres-Merman square. It's not the same one I showed you before. This is kind of the original and most famous of these types of proofs. But again, we can pre-select this Bell state here that has all plus eigenvalues. We can post-select on this product X state. We again force the violation to be up here. But now the interpretation will be sort of different. We'll say that if the first qubit is the path in the interferometer right-left, so plus is left, minus is right, and the second qubit for Z is the spin, so up or down, then we end up concluding that because of those force values, you know, we got these. These obviously violate the product rule. But we interpret this plus. This says, okay, the neutron was definitely in the left path. And if we interpret this over here, it says the neutron definitely had spin up. But now we look at this one, and this says actually there are two possibilities. Either the thing was on the right path with spin up, or on the left path with spin down, which again contradicts, you know, these original two statements. So one way you can interpret this ontologically is to say that the neutron's spin becomes disembodied from the neutron itself. And so these can, you can think that all of these will be satisfied if the neutron without a spin takes the left path, and the spin without a neutron takes the right path. And this is the quantum Cheshire Cat phenomenon, where you would say that you have a cat without a smile. That's not so weird, but a smile without a cat is pretty weird. That's where the name comes from. All right. And lastly, I want to talk about pre- and post-selection paradoxes, something Avi already mentioned for us. So there's a class of paradoxes which sort of originated with the time-symmetric quantum formalism, where you sort of assume already that you have some pre- and post-selection, and then you look for a contradiction that you obtain using only the ABL rule. So these are not generally going to be complete Kochan-Specker sets, which would give you state-independent contextuality. But anytime you get one of these paradoxes, you can actually see, this is the same paper I mentioned before about the ABL values, you can see that there is actually a way to generalize this into a full logical proof of contextuality. So by logical, we mean that all the values assigned are going to be 0 and 1 for projectors, even using the ABL formalism. And there's a way to get to a full structure. Basically, what you have to do is add a few more counterfactual measurements or states to complete your measurements, and then you find that there's a proof of contextuality that the 0-1 assignment doesn't make any sense for the projectors. But this is kind of the crucial point here, is that even when you find this type of thing where you don't have a full Kochan-Specker set, you do still find that there has to have been an anomalous weak value for this to happen. And that anomalous weak value is, again, this evidence of confined contextuality. We know right where the violation of classical realism is because we know where this anomalous weak value is. So let's actually go through the three-box paradox example. again, Avi already told us all of this stuff. So we have this pre-selection, this post-selection, where 1, 2, 3 are our three boxes. So the particle begins having equal probability to be in each box. It also ends with equal probability to be in each box. And these are the weak values of the three boxes. And there's this negative 1 for the projector here. So the paradox, we actually find the paradox by looking at two different coarse grain bases of this three. So if we combine boxes 1 and 3 into a rank 2 projector, we get a basis that has cardinality 2. And so that rule we used earlier follows that we now find with certainty that because the weak value here is 0, that's what this is telling us here, and this one was 1, the particle has to be in box 1, and also it has to be in box 2 using these two different coarse grain bases. So this is one basis where I combine boxes 1 and 3, and this is another one where I combine boxes 2 and 3. And then applying these, I find this paradox. The ABL rule tells us with certainty we would always find the particle in one box, and also we would always find it in the other box. And again, in order for this to happen, I needed this sum in here to be 0. And that's why I needed to have a negative weak value. It would have been impossible to get this paradox without having a negative weak value for one of the projectors. Okay. All right. So now again, let's look at ontological interpretations of this. So again, Avi already told us this, but instead of assigning like realism to the actual eigenvalues that were forced, which were only the positive ones, we can also try to ascribe realism just to all the weak values in general. And then we'll conclude that this negative weak value has to have some ontological meaning. And the way that Yakir has explained it, he hasn't really pinned down exactly a name for this, but I guess the latest name is phantom particle. So there's a phantom particle that appears between the pre and post selection, and that phantom particle has all the negative properties of the original particle, and that explains why this projector has a negative value. So there's a kind of way this makes sense, right? We can say that every conservation law was obeyed because really there should only have been one particle, but I found an extra one. The particle seems to be in both box 1 and 2 with certainty, and there's this negative particle. So in total, the original one plus the extra copy and the negative copy, which sum to 0 in all ways, conserves everything. So we can kind of see this as like an extra pair popping out of the vacuum and then disappearing after the post-selection has been made, or prior to the post-selection. So this raises an interesting sort of conundrum. I was hoping Akir would be here for this, but he had to leave. So if we go back and look at our Cheshire cat and our pigeonhole case, really it was these confined contextuality experiments with the 3-qubit square and the Peres Roman square. These are the weak values we find for the 4 projectors. So when we came up with our story about the pigeonhole and the Cheshire cat, we looked at what the ABL eigenvalues that were forced were, and we tried to interpret those. But again, that context that violates the product rule doesn't correspond to any physical state, which is why we have to interpret it in such a paradoxical way. You know, we end up with interpretations that seem to make almost no sense in both cases. But the same exact physical problem, we get these weak values here. And so we could say that maybe this negative 1/2 over here can be interpreted also in some kind of phantom particle picture where we've had a negative particle pop into existence in the intermediate time. So, for example, if these projectors are, I think I didn't put them in any particular order, so let's say this is for the Cheshire cat, left with spin up, left with spin down, right with spin up, right with spin down. We might be forced to conclude that in one of the arms of the interferometer, there was a neutron that appeared out of the vacuum and propagated, and there was an extra copy of the original one as well. And he would interpret the halves here as being probabilities of these things happening between the pre and post selections from what he said before. So I'm not really sure which of these is more physically real or physically plausible as an ontology. There are two different ways to interpret the same thing. So I'm not sure what Yakir would prefer or what he might say about this. But I think it's interesting anyway, and it's worth looking into further. And with that, I will conclude. So just to recap, we've shown that if you have a state-independent proof of BKS theorem, where you've ruled out some non-contextual hidden variable model, if you add a pre and post selection to that, you can confine just where the violation will be, and then you can use weak measurements to really observe that it's there. We've actually done the experiment with 17 individual qubits or different ensembles in this neutron interferometer, And we find roughly this correlation, minus one for every pair. So in the experiment we actually did, it's as though every pair were anticorrelated, even though that doesn't really make sense from a box counting argument. And also, it's pretty strange given that these particles never even existed at the same time. It still looks like they're anticorrelated in this conditional way. And we've looked at some of the ontological interpretations for these different things, tried to sort of make some sense of what all of this tells us if we really want to have a clear ontology that respects what we see using these extra pre and post selection rules. All right, that's it. Thank you. I don't know how I did on time.
Thank you, Craig. Wonderful. Unfortunately, we are totally out of time.
Yeah, I went over. I just noticed that now.
But we Tony's on the schedule, so I'll make sure we don't run too late. So be sure to ask Kai questions. It's really fascinating work.
Yeah, if you have questions, we can talk later on. Justin, here's your hockey stick.
All right, thank you.